Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 41.
41.
So last night, Lindsay and I went to Uniondale, New York to see the final performance of Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Combined Circuses. It was a pretty sad evening, to be totally honest. The show was amazing. The performers were really giving it their all. And you could really, particularly the Cossack riders were really going full energy. And it was a really cool way to see Ringling. I don't think I've ever seen Ringling either that close. We sat in the second row, or sort of with that level of stakes where you could really feel the performers just giving it 110%. But, you know, it had an interesting atmosphere to the whole environment, because sort of everybody in the audience knew what was happening. As we were walking in, we could hear people talking about, this is the last circus ever, or the last Ringling ever. And it was very much in the atmosphere of the performance.
Yeah, one guy had a big camera, like a Canon, a real camera. And the guy was like, you can't bring that in. He was like, it's the last circus show ever. And I was like, well, that's not true, but it's the last Ringling show for now. So he was always sad because his kids were there and he wanted to photograph it. But yeah, it was cool sitting second row. I've never sat that close on a Ringling show. You could tell everyone really wanted to like nail their tricks. So the trapeze squad, the trapeze group, what do you call a group of trapeze artists?
Troupe.
A troupe. A trapeze troupe. They were trying to do a quadruple backflip. And we saw the trapeze group that were in Big Apple 2 years ago try this. Didn't get it. So I was really hoping that we would get it, that we would see someone get it. He was like, got ready. And then they made contact and they fell. And so I was like, one more time. And I was like, this is what I love about circus. The fact that you can really like see someone miss a trick and then root for them to get it the next time. Like in theater, you know, it's not, if they forget a line, you try to cover it up and move on, you know. But circus, you know, it feels like you're part of the show almost. So sad, and he didn't get it the second time, but it was still a fun, thing to watch. And what's the, animal trainer's name?
Alexander Lacey.
Regardless of how you feel about animals in the circus, he's just like such a great performer, and those lions and tigers are just amazing. And there was this one tiger that was named Zaw, who reminded me of our dog, who was like the whole time he was doing the tricks, but then like looking at the audience like, is it time yet to do the next? Oh, nope, not yet. And then like would lay back down and he'd look up again and be like, oh shoot, it's not time yet. He was like so cute. But it was really sad to see it.
Yeah, I'm really hoping we can actually have Alexander Lacey on the podcast, talk about animal training.
Yeah.
If any of our fans out there know him personally, shoot us a message to connect us. But to be honest, I've never really been a big fan of animal acts. But for the first, I mean, I love dogs and horse acts. I'm sort of more referring to exotic animals in that statement. But I feel like last night might have changed my opinion a little bit about big cat acts. I don't really know why, but sort of just seeing it up close from the second row, seeing the animals actually look like they're having a great time with the trainer, listening to the trainer talk after the performance. I think, I don't know for sure because I haven't seen this show, but I think he went on a little longer with his monologue at the end, sort of commenting more about animals and their place in circus, and this conceptual understanding of that if you see animals interact with humans in a friendly and fun way, it is different from just seeing it on planet Earth. When you watch it on planet Earth, which had previously been my defense, is why do we have animals in circus? Can't you just watch them on TV and see them in their natural habitat? Basically, what Alexander Lacey is saying to that is that what that basically paints a tiger as this killing machine hunting the gazelle, and you watch this main footage, and what seeing something on planet Earth doesn't really show that you get in the circus is that these animals have personalities and can interact with humans, and it changes your perspective of sort of their, maybe souls isn't the right word, but sort of the relationship between an animal and a person, and makes it less an exotic thing and more something that you might personally care about, and then go and give money to zoos. Or
when you see them up close, they're just like massive cats. I mean, they are cats, right? But they're just like a massive house cat, because they do the same, like with his little stick that he would like point them around with. they would try to swat it the whole time, just like my cat does with anything. And it's, I don't know, it's, you know, it's interesting. And seeing the horse riding act, which was like just incredible, was insane. And, you know, there's definitely validity to having animals in the circus. It's, you know, a tradition. And, but I also understand not wanting them in the circus, but oh, it was really nice to be there last night. And like a real, even though they were trying to make it a more contemporary, whatever that means, circus, it still was like, you know, such a traditional American circus that, you know, so many families and people have seen and been affected by. And it's sad that it's done after 146 years. And I'm definitely going to miss it. I definitely shed some tears last night. I still have like the programs from like the 90s when my parents brought me to see Ringling. So I bought the program last night.
But the 1990s or the 1890s?
I wish it was the 1890s. It was the 1990s. I wish I had programs from then. That'd be sweet. But alas.
One of the things that I think I'm going to miss about Ringling as well is just they always seem to introduce me to one or two new acts I haven't seen live. Last night they had a number called Semaphore, which I'd seen video footage of online, black and white video footage of it being in Ringling, I think in the 30s or 40s. But basically it's sort of like Wheel of Death meets Tight Wire, and you sort of walk on the outside of the spinning apparatus. That was kind of cool to see in person. And then for those who haven't seen the show, one of the things that makes it different is that they sort of combined some of the things from their from other Feld ice shows into Ringling. So half the arena was still covered in ice. So we saw an ice skating bonking combination act where like people were being thrown and doing like doubles onto people's shoulders while wearing ice skates, which I cannot imagine is comfortable for the bases. I mean, I think they have padded like shoulders, but yeah. I was like, ooh,
I know.
There's no way that feels comfortable having like two blades on your shoulders like that.
You know, that's like, you know, one of the, I would say, criticisms that I had about the show is, or just like in general arena shows, it's hard to, you know, since you have to play to so many people, it's such a massive space. So many people are sitting far away. You have to have a lot going on and big things, right? And so then just doing, you know, a simple contortion act or a quiet contortion act, I should say.
It doesn't, the middle of the bonking number.
It doesn't work. But if you they put this contortion act in the middle of this bonking number, so you don't even see these three like amazing contortionists. And then there's these aerialists. There's six of them happening. So you can't even appreciate any one of them, you know, so it's like, I get why you do it, but at the same time, you lose a lot of the like the specialty acts that are like quieter and really beautiful, but just because of the space, like they don't work. But part of the ice skating, they did a fire ice skating.
Oh yeah, they lit the whole ice on fire for that.
They did, and then they at one point had like these limbo poles, basically that were lit on fire, and these guys were like jumping over them on ice skates and like sliding under them.
You're missing who was holding the limbo poles.
Who are holding the limbo poles?
People on Segways.
Oh, no, they weren't holding them. Stagehands are holding the poles, but people on Segways with fire in their hands were on stage as well. Again, what? Like, wow, there's just a lot happening. So much happening. And also one of the artistic choices that I was like really into because I thought it was hilarious was they did this animal act number with all the dogs and the like llamas and goats and pigs to Katy Perry's California Girls.
Nothing like a pig act to California Girls. At the end of the show, I don't know if this was caught on the live stream because I didn't watch the live stream because we were there. Johnny Lee Iverson, who is the ringmaster, sort of brought all the families out, all the crew out, and you could see, you know, a couple hundred people standing in the center of this arena just bawling and taking photos with their phones and hugging one another as he sort of acknowledged all the various departments. I thought it was a really just nice way to go out.
Mm-hmm.
But send our love to those who are in the show and are now looking for the next step in their journey. Thank you for giving us an awesome performance. And Ringling will miss you. See you down the road.
We also saw a different show, way different show, one man show, going from like a cast of like, I don't know, what felt like 100 to one man. This show called Darren Brown Secret at Atlantic Theater Company, which is basically a mentalist show and like a sleight of hand show. And he's really popular in London. Never has done anything in the United States. This is his first show in the US. It's The run is sold out. They extended 3 weeks because of the popularity. I think for people that have never seen something like it, it's really crazy. Like
it's
my mom.
It's a magic show.
Yeah, it's a magic show. My mom was like, oh my God, how did he do that? And you know, I think if you've seen some of these things before, you kind of like are like, okay, I get how he did that. It was really, it was a fun night.
Definitely. It's the genre of mentalism and reading one's mind in magic. It's not my personal favorite, but
if you see someone like Mark Mitten do up close magic and sleight of hand, it's just incredible. And I've had the pleasure of seeing Mark after, you know, knowing him for a few years and just being like in awe. And I would say like, I didn't get that feeling all the time from the Darren Brown show, but for like,
I thought what the Darren Brown
good.
Show really did well was, use some greater principles of magic as through lines. So one of the things that he talks about, which I feel is okay to talk about because it's not really a trick, is how storytelling in magic works, and that essentially what is happening is that he is providing you pieces of information and he's letting you put the story together. Mm-hmm. And then you put the story together and then you see the whatever the magic element is, and it seems unbelievable between what the story you have in your mind is and what the result is that you see on stage. And he sort of parallels that to his life and current politics and just various different things mm-hmm. throughout the show. And I thought it was a really neat way to use
that. Yeah, it was the
theme.
First kind of thing that I saw where I was really trying to be a play with magic and illusion and sleight of hand and stuff.
You wouldn't say that about the show we saw at Signature?
Nothing to Hide.
Nothing to Hide?
I thought that I enjoyed Nothing to Hide more. I liked the fact, I mean, the thing is it's easier to have more variety when there's two people on stage versus one. But I thought Darren Brown was like there was a writer and like he had these like monologues and stories. I don't remember if Nothing to Hide did, but I felt like they had great banter and great segues. But I think theirs was more like magic. This is a magic show. Whereas Darren Brown's was like my life story with magic. You know, definitely. I don't know. But if you are interested, you should go check it out. It's at Atlantic playing until, I forget when it's playing.
Yeah, two or three more weeks. We're recording this mid-May. So if you catch it before mid-June, you should be good.
But he sells out like stadiums in London. So it's cool to see him in a really small house. Well, not small house, but you know, like a $2.99 or $1.99. I forget what that is.
So I think the last piece of news we want to chat about, circus news, is Big Apple Circus, which announced that Grandma, Barry Lubin, a previous guest of the podcast, is going back out for the 40th anniversary. So that's going to be great to see Barry back in the ring. They also announced that they're going back to Lincoln Center, which is a surprise to Lindsay and I, who had been talking about both in the podcast and off the podcast how we think that that's a challenging site to return to and an expensive one. But it's great that they managed to secure it once again.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just confused by the fact that it's like, they're essentially doing a show that has existed in some form previously and doing it in the same exact location. And it's what basically was the show that like couldn't sell enough tickets to fund itself. It's either a really brilliant choice to bring it back after a year and people are like dying to see it again, or it's a really, really bad choice. And I don't know what it's going to be until obviously it happens.
Yes.
But not bad as in like the show is going to be bad, but bad as in like, is it going to sell tickets? Because are people actually wanting
tickets,
that?
One thing I think they're doing way better this year than in years past is their social media campaigning.
Yes.
They did this really neat thing. I think it was 2 weeks ago. They did Ringmaster auditions and then streamed those Ringmaster auditions on their Instagram story. So you could see clips of all the possible Ringmasters doing like little moments with Barry and with Mark Lonergan, who's the director, and with Joel Jeske, who's the writer. And, it's pretty cool. Like you could just seeing all the possible variations. They announced who their ringmaster is. I don't know off the top of my head, but Google it online. He seems like a talented singing actor who has some circus experience. But exciting to hear more news from Big Apple, mm-hmm. sort of to counteract some of the darker news coming out of Ringling.
Yeah. But this week on our podcast, we had Peter Bufano.
I've known Peter for a long time, since I was maybe 15. Peter is an amazing circus composer, clown, musician, multidisciplinarian. And on the episode, we talk a lot about Peter's career, but we also talk about circus, how you write music for circus.
Or how you pick music for your act.
And Peter did this really cool thing for us which I had requested beforehand, called a Song Exploder, which is a reference to another podcast called Song Exploder. Go check it out. But basically what we do is he takes apart his song, The Romantic, breaks it down so you can sort of understand why he wrote the different elements of it, and hopefully that will give you a really cool insight into his musical writing process.
And if you stay through all the way to the end, after the episode, after we say our goodbyes, you'll hear we have a piano in our office, and I asked him if he could just write a song with these three flat notes that I love, A flat, E flat, and B flat. And he was like, tell me what the scene is. And we just came up with it off the top of our head. It's pretty silly, but it's pretty amazing to see how he can just like write this beautiful piece of music in a second. So if you are interested, it's at the very end of the episode. If you like our podcast, please make sure to follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, rate us on iTunes, Twitter tweet us, or you can email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com. Here's Peter.
Peter, where are you from originally?
Born in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Oh, home of P.T. Barnum.
Yes, home of P.T. Barnum. Grew up in Connecticut and Massachusetts.
I didn't know you were from Bridgeport. What was Bridgeport like when you were growing up in it? Because, you know, it's industrial. It's industrial, but it's also had just like general problems.
I think it was probably bad news. But, you know, like I was, when we actually lived in Bridgeport, I was 1 year. Till I was one.
Oh, okay.
So I remember very little.
Where in Massachusetts did you live?
We lived in Tewksbury, Mass. Oh, that's north, you know, because you're from Boston.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where are you from in Boston?
Southwest, but okay. Medfield, it's very...
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I know it. Well, but I did live in Connecticut. Like, I lived in Shelton, Connecticut until I was in high school, we moved for high school. Like when we got to Massachusetts, I was in high school.
You moved basically to Massachusetts for the school?
Yeah, for the fine high school. No, because my dad had a shift of jobs. My dad's an inventor. He's a retired inventor now.
What kind of stuff does he invent?
He invents, like, if you look at the patents or the things that they are, looks like nothing. Looks like he made this stuff. It looks like he made this stuff up in his head. Like, that's like, oh, he's not really an inventor. That's not really a patent. Like, it's numbers, it's formulas, like, it's math.
Yeah.
Or circuits, you know, or whatever. But they are things like he worked for Exxon in the 70s, and they invented the inkjet printer. Like, him and a handful of guys.
That's awesome.
That's amazing, right? Yes. And my dad can't get his inkjet printer to work either. Like, we can't. Like, it's the same thing.
He was inventing it.
Yeah.
Did your mom have any musical talent? Where did you get it from?
My mom always says, oh, I'm tone deaf. Like, she completely disassociates herself from any kind of musical influence for some reason. But my dad's side of the family, and actually my mom's dad, musicians. There's musicians all over the family. Like, I'm from a family of musicians, really. And so my grandfather on my mother's side, he was Hungarian and an accordion player. So that's that influence. And they were all, like, that whole side of the family. The grandparents are born in Hungary. And my parents are both born in Manhattan. On my father's side, they're all Italians, born in the United States and Italy. And all, like, musicians, you know. So there's musicians around.
What was the first instrument you learned?
I learned everything. Like, I wanted every instrument in the house. I wanted to play everything. So I had a piano, I had an accordion, we had guitars.
Was your mom like, oh my God, stop playing all these instruments?
No. My parents are like, I don't know if you ever really know what your parents thought of you when you're a kid. Like, do you ever find out what they really thought?
I don't know.
I think
my mom was like, we were just hoping you would grow out of it.
Yeah, I think that's the deal. I have no idea. I mean, honestly, I could ask them now. Like, my sister used to say, oh, they brag about you all the time. It's horrible. Because my sister was the youngest. And she always said, oh, I grew up in your shadow. Like, they bragged about you to everybody. When you went and joined the circus, like, all they did was brag about you. That's what I always heard from her, but not from them. From them, I heard, like, you have to do something different. Like, you need either a plan B or, like, make plan B, plan A, or, like, but don't do this crap. Like, they were concerned about it, like, as a career choice.
What was the first circus show you saw?
Probably Ringling. I mean, I grew up watching Ringling.
Do you remember how old you are when you saw it for the first time?
Probably 5 years old, maybe younger. I remember seeing it when I was five. I remember seeing it in New Haven, Hartford, Boston, Madison Square Garden many times. I can see it. I remember sitting there, I'm like in the nosebleed seats, loving the sway pole act, like seeing the person, like you're almost at the same height as the person on top of this giant sway pole. It was like the classic sway pole with a drunk clown on the top. And then there's a breakaway, like it looks
like
it breaks.
It's not like a limbo sway pole where it's like rock, yeah.
No, totally not that one. I love that act though.
It was super cool.
That was a
surprise.
Although
the whole time I was like, please don't break. But then I learned how they break and it's not like how you would imagine.
Right. And still, wouldn't it be great if they broke anyways?
No. Yeah, someone was on a sway pole and broke and fell on me. If I saw Hilton Dennis like plummeting towards me, though, I'd be like, no.
But I've seen shit like that in circuses. Like, I've seen accidents, you know, or things like unplanned, unfortunate things. Yeah. And in a way, it's like, that probably has in some way helped keep the circus alive. Like, that's possible,
right?
You know?
So you see Ring Ling, you're playing instruments. Is your brain as a child more towards, like, I want to be a musician or I want to be in the circus or something totally else?
That is like a conflict that I didn't resolve until like I was in my 30s. Like I really dealt with it as a problem of like, oh, I have to choose one of these things. Mm. You know, like I have to either be a musician or I have to be in the circus. Like it was an unresolvable conflict for a long time. I did like, and it's weird anyways, like as a child to even be thinking about this stuff or worry about it. But I did, like when we saw Ring Ling, I immediately saw myself as like, oh, I'm on the wrong side of this exchange. Like, I'm misplaced. Like, I need to be down there. This is not the right place for me to be sitting here watching this thing. Like, I'm down there. So, like, I understood that part of it immediately. Like, love at first sight kind of a reaction. But the idea that, like, oh, all of this is a kind of a unified thing of, like, it's not about your job title or these kind of distinctions, you know, that it's an evolving thing and whatever, you are yourself and you go do what you want to do in that moment. And so I think it was like, I had already gone through, I'd worked in the circus as a clown. I mean, I know I'm skipping a lot of stuff. We'll
You're
get caught
skipping
up.
Ahead, I know. Peter. We haven't even gone through high school.
I had like a very good start of a career working for Ringling Brothers as a clown. I got into the clown college and I was a clown. I did that. And then I spent like my 20s trying to redirect the whole thing into a music career. And I moved to LA and started assisting these big shot composers on doing music for films and stuff. And still was like, why do I have to choose this? This doesn't feel like it's me. This feels like it's me forcing myself into this other. I hadn't really found that.
You
like,
sort of create
thing.
These distinctions for yourself.
Yeah.
I think people do that a lot though, especially in the arts. It's like you have to do one or the other. You can't be a producer and also be an actor.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And I felt that a little bit too, just because you feel like, God, I have to focus on it to be successful at it. And I can't, there's no way I can do both. Right. But now I see a lot of people doing playwriting and being an actor and writing work for themselves. And, but it seems like now you kind of chose music.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that really, I guess what I've chosen, like, is exactly the kind of thing you're describing. Is that like I've chosen that, like this is the music I make and people seem to need it in the circus. So that's where I'm going to hang out as long as that's interesting, as long as I can make a contribution there. Mm-hmm. And that it doesn't have to fit like, oh, I'm just the producer or I'm just an actor or I'm just a costume designer or I'm just a set designer. It's like, well, you have some contribution to make. Who's going to say that it's not valid if you're doing both things or whatever. I mean, I haven't worked in the ring. I haven't been a clown in a long time. But it's interesting that when I was working for Spiegelworld over the last few years, people were like, well, this guy was a clown. Don't just stick him at a piano and tell him to play the piano. Like, he's going to tell some jokes. He's going to be funny. He's going to have lines on stage.
You had jokes in the show we saw you in last week.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Family circus show.
Yeah. I mean, there is a thing that, like, I don't need a definition. I don't need, like, although there always is one. People throw a job title at you, and then the next thing you know, you're doing something else. And so I didn't really resolve all that. I thought I had to. If I was going to succeed in music, I had to do something in music that I saw other people doing, like scoring films or whatever, something I could get a degree in.
Oh, you thought that you couldn't do music in circus. It had to be something else.
Yeah, I thought that that if I was going to enter the music business, I was going to enter the music business, that it wouldn't be in the circus business or whatever. So I just really was pursuing music in the film business for my 20s. That's what I was doing. Like, I went to Berklee College of Music and I got my diploma in film scoring. And then I moved to LA, started like pursuing that. Not like, I mean, I had, I reached my goals. You know, like I like went moved to LA with like a list of goals. Like I want to do this, this, and this in 5 years. You know, and then like 6 months, I had like that was done. You know, and I was like, but I don't really know if this is me. And Kelly Van Cleve, who I knew from Ringling Brothers, called me and said, "Oh, Kenosha Circus is hiring a bunch of clowns, and they need to be musical clowns." I'm like, "Would you come back?" And I just like I didn't even look back. I threw all my crap that I had in LA like into a storage unit, and I went to Japan, and I was like back in the ring again. But I was playing the accordion, and I was like making music now, and it was like the first kind of realization of, oh, there is some. This is not going to wind up being a cookie cutter career. It doesn't ever have to be held to the standard of like, well, I saw someone else do this and they succeeded. That doesn't have to be the agenda. It's like, what can I do right now at this moment that is somehow contributing something, you know? And if I can repeat that, that's amazing. And if someone will pay me, that's amazing. But what can I do right now? You know? And so that's where I've been since then, since that kind of realization. It's like, what can I do right now? Oh, you need me to write some music? Good. Here's 2 hours of music. Oh, you need me to play some music? Great. Here's an instrument. You know, as you need me to tell a joke? Great. Here's a joke. You know, so what can I do right now?
Jumping back a little bit chronologically, what was the step that sort of introduced you to clown college? Was there a circus interaction, I want to be a clown or an actor before that? Or was that really the first thing?
I think the first clue I got about like clown college and that it was something I would pursue was there was this book that I had like pretty early on, like before I was even old enough to think about going to clown college. There was a book called A Very Young Circus Flyer, which is maybe it was from National Geographic books. It's like a picture book for kids.
Yeah.
There was pictures of people in there. I'd later find out these were like, oh, here's Ruthie Chadwick, you know, and like people I know and right. studied with and worked with, you know? And so that was a thing where it was like not just pictures of the show, it was pictures backstage, pictures on the train. And I was like, that is more and more I'm beginning to understand the details of this world and how that works. And there was an article in a magazine about clown college. So then like I understood what it was, and I was like too young to apply and hadn't even really pursued finding out how you do that. And it kind of landed in my lap. Like somebody said, hey, the Ringling's in Worcester, or Ringling's at the Boston Garden, like, and they're having the auditions. Like, why don't you just show up? And I would just show up. And I did it twice. I guess I was 17 when I did that. I was 16 and 17 when I went to auditions.
Were your friends in high school like, wait, you're auditioning to be a clown? Or
I had no friends in high school. I was no one liked me. Probably. Again, it's one of those things where it's like, if we did an archaeological dig, if we went back and asked like people, like, right. Do you remember Peter Bufano? And when he was like, probably some people would say something nice about me.
Massachusetts is hard though. You didn't go to school in Worcester.
Yeah, but clearly you did the same thing that I did, which was you went to a new high school.
Yeah,
for high school, which makes finding friends its own separate yeah. set of challenges when you're totally. A new kid as a freshman as well.
I think Lindsay's right too. Like, I think Massachusetts is it's a culturally jarring place. Yeah. Yeah. People are not subtle.
No, they're not.
There's nothing wrong, and they're not hateful people. But if you're from somewhere else, you might think they are.
Yeah. Wait, you're not from Massachusetts? You were not born here? Oh
yeah.
my gosh.
Yeah.
So you auditioned. Twice?
Yeah, I auditioned twice without like, I mean, it was twice because the show played in Worcester and then some short time later they played in Boston. So I was just like, I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't like, well, I already auditioned. Maybe that's a good audition. And who knows what those auditions were? Because then, you know, I got it in and then I got on the Red Show and I was working. And so I was on the other side of those auditions. And honestly, I don't know what the F we were doing at those auditions. They were mostly publicity events.
Yeah.
I mean,
so who else was in your class at clown college, or who were your anybody in your
Ted Lawrence, class? You might know Ted Lawrence, Jeff Jenkins,
yeah.
Ted Furlow, the late great.
Yeah. I didn't realize Jeff Jenkins went to clown college.
Yeah.
Oh man, all these people.
And Jeff Jenkins was a person who was kind of pivotal in launching my career as a composer for circus, like specifically. Like,
was he doing Smirkus when you
He was did? Directing Smirkus and was already really involved. He was like a big influencer on the aesthetic of Smirkus in the early 2000s. And I was just back from Japan where I'd met Adam Kukler and he introduced me to the Bindlestiffs. But like at that stage, I hadn't written music for circuses. I was performing. I'd played in circuses. I'd subbed for other musicians in circuses. I had ideas. And I had all this training in composition from, like, right, studying film scoring and everything. And I had all this experience watching circuses from when I was five, you know, and being a clown in the circus. I certainly had the trust of people I knew in the circus world, like, that I understood their individual disciplines. Mm-hmm. That, like, if someone who did trapeze were to come to me and say, well, what would you play for this? Or what music would you write for this? They could actually ask me from the perspective that I know what right, their act is, you know? So that was the groundwork of this. And I had subbed for a Bindlestiff production in Times Square, like, for a run, like, for a number of weeks, where their main composer slash musician, this guy Raja Azar, was taking days off to do a puppet show. He had, like, created this pirate puppet show in the early 2000s at the beginning of the pirate craze. He may have fueled the pirate craze, the pirate puppet craze.
So, which is, like, a massive craze.
You know, it's,
I mean,
nuts.
I'm a big Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean fan, but not so much pirate puppets, but I'm into it.
Well, I've never been, like, a huge fan of Johnny Depp, but anything with a pirate is okay with me. So I'll just say that out there. Anyways, so I was subbing with the Bindlestiffs, and then, like, Jeff Jenkins pops out of the audience after a show. And I hadn't seen him since Clown College. I mean, it had been over a decade. You know, I hadn't seen him since Clown College. And he just pops out of the audience, and he was like, why don't you come do Smirkus this summer? Why don't you put together a band and write the score? So he was pivotal.
Is that Alice? What
year? Yes. Yeah, it was the Alice in Wonderland. Yeah.
So that's 2004.
I guess that's right. Yeah, 2004. So yeah, how many, like, years ago is that? That's 13 years ago. So that's, I mean, since then, what I've done is written music for circuses. And that was, like, just a moment where, like, a switch flipped, because Jeff Jenkins happened to be in the audience one night, my connection from Clown College, and, like, just popped out. Who knows what, I mean, really how this would have come about and in what way.
What do you feel like is the biggest difference between if you score a movie versus a circus show?
I don't think there's any difference in a way. There's no right, difference.
Like, the biggest difference is a vamp. Constant vamp.
Yeah.
Wait yeah, for the trick.
It's all just boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom.
And he hit
No, in the sense, okay, it's obviously very different, because circus music sounds totally different than movie music. Yes, that thing. But in both of those worlds, you have to be totally versatile anyways. You have to be able to write anything. So here's why I think it's the same thing, is that, like, it's not the writing the music part. If I do getting ready to write music correctly and thoroughly, the music just writes itself. It literally just comes out and just keeps coming out until my deadline.
What do you do to get ready to write music?
You're just asking yourself the question the whole time. Like, you're looking at the scene in the movie, or you're looking at the act on the stage, or you're looking at the clowns, or you're looking at, like, the opening number or the ringmaster. You're looking at something. It might be a script, it might be a video, it might be a description from a director describing it. It might be a rehearsal. You're looking at it and you're just going, why does this need music? Why does this need music? And if you just sit there long enough asking that question, you're going to come up with, like, one of two results. Either A, you're going to say, well, I guess it just doesn't. Like, I can't think of any reason why. So I'm done. Like, and then next, yeah, you know? Or B, oh, it needs music because we need to be scared, or this needs music because we need a rhythm to propel this act forward and give us, like, an anticipation. We need music because we need to create an emotional world for this act to live in. It has no emotion without music. Or we need music to create a physical world. We want it to appear that, like, this whole thing's taking place in a tiny little bedroom, but we can't bring a tiny little bedroom to a circus ring and put it here and exclude the audience. So, like, how can we bring this to it? You know, or we need music to communicate to the audience, okay, now it's 100 years earlier than where we were before this act. Mm-hmm. We've just gone back in time 100 years. So whatever it is, like, I mean, I could keep going, but you just sit there and you look at this thing and you go, why does this need music? Why does this need music? And that is composing to me. That's all it is. It's the same in a movie. It's the same in the circus, and it's the same probably for a video game, which I've never done. But like, you're just saying, why does this need music? And that could take minutes, hours, weeks, months to puzzle it out. But that's all you're doing. Once you have that figured out, it's just so fast and so easy. You don't even think about it.
So like Les Mis, they're like, this entire story needs music. There's not one moment where
well,
it doesn't.
Well, okay, a musical is a very particular thing. And I haven't written a musical, really.
I was about to ask, so, do you think you ever will?
I wrote something called My Last Circus for the Bindlestiffs, which had songs that were like the inner thoughts and the dialogue of characters.
In the Spiegel tent.
Yeah, we did it in the Spiegel tent. Yeah. I mean, it was in a way like it was the perfect show to do with the Bindlestiffs because I really wrote it about Stephanie. Mm-hmm. And it was really inspired by her.
Stephanie, who's their ringmaster mistress. Is
yeah.
That what she calls
them? Yeah. And also Stephanie, who's their person who is like, if there's one person associated with the Bindlestiffs who has the dilemma of like, to be or not to be. Like, should I be doing this? Like, Stephanie is the person who asks that question. Or why should I be doing this or whatever. She's that person who's going through that. So, like, and I go through that. So I identify with her a lot. And I was like, it's the perfect, you know, show to write this for. But at the same time, I've learned, like, now I've written a second show for them that got discarded this year. And I realized, like, it's also, like, not the perfect show to write for because they kind of thrive on not having a script. Mm-hmm. And they thrive on some things that you can't write in a narrative. You know, and so so My Last Circus was like a musical in a way. It was the closest thing I ever did to a musical, but it was a ridiculous amount of work and it was really forcing everyone into a thing that was way out of their wheelhouse, you know. It was like, and Joel Jeske directed it, came out, and everybody really tried, but it had like dialogue and songs and a lot of, the contributions were amazing. Dobson was involved, E-Cat was there, Richie, what's Richie's last
McGuire.
Name? Yeah, Richie McGuire. Who else was in that? There was other people. Oh, who's that weird juggle kid who like doesn't even throw the Brian P. Daly.
Oh, yeah.
Brian P. Daly was in it, you know, like in PJs, like footsie PJs and doing his thing. And I mean, everybody had these concepts and it was like, I still think it's a beautiful, I want someone else to do this show, actually, to produce this show. It's a beautiful idea where like the ringmaster, ringmistress, whatever, has run away from the circus to join the world, but they can't function without her. So they're actually like on tour, they keep finding out where she is and they go to the town where she is and trick her into doing one more show, her last circus. And she's always like, she caves in. She's like, okay, I'll do it one more time.
But what I wanted to ask you about was...
Sorry, I derailed it.
No, it's okay. All right. The two things also don't necessarily have too much to do with one another. But I wanted to ask sort of how you found your, I don't know if style is the right word, but sort of the genre in which most of your circus music lives in when you were discovering it the first time.
Your musical voice, your tone, your tempo.
I'm always still getting it. I honestly, like, it is an elusive hunt to go find it. I do, when I write a piece of music, I go, is this me? Is this me? What could I change to make this me? Can I move this one note? Could I make the whole thing slower? Could I make it faster? Like, I am always asking that question. Does this sound like me? So, you know, how do you judge that? How do you decide that? Then there's songs where I'll put it on an album and I'll go, oh God, why is that on the album? That's not me. That's not enough me. And then years later, I'll listen to it and have a totally different opinion. I'll be like, no, that really was me at the time. It's me now. Like, it fits now. So there's this love-hate thing going on.
But I mean, even sort of a step backwards from that, like, just the instruments you chose originally, like just the accordion being in a feature. And I know very little about music, so I might make an analogy to you, but that's not at all what it is. But this maybe like a klezmer-esque sort of sound to it if somebody hasn't heard it before. A lot of strings. Like, was that a thing you just sort of like knew and associated with circus? Or was that a thing you sort of had to really think, what sounds like circus to me?
I mean, this is a really complicated, nuanced question. I could really talk about this for like a 3-hour podcast. I mean, the first thing I want to say is that, like, you're influenced by everything. Like, I'm looking at buildings out your window now, and I'm like, look at the architecture, look at the space, like, and I'm hearing, like, what would that music be? So, like, I'm constantly taking stuff in and then just putting it back out. That's happening. So you're always a filter as a creator. You guys know that. You created a show. So, you know, stuff comes in and then you kind of spit it out in your way, and now it's different. you know?
And so we added the podcast and don't include this part.
Exactly. I have a really good composition teacher I've studied with for like most of my career. This guy, Lawrence Schrag, who lives in LA. He's scored more like made for TV movies than you can count, and feature films and stuff too that are, you know, like if I start rattling off the names of them, they might not be ones you heard because he's not like John Williams, but he's a great composer. It's like he's an amazing composer in so many ways. And we're friends. And he's always taken the time. He's been so generous to listen to what I do and then like teach me about myself as a composer. So he has been really instrumental. And I never stopped studying with him. Like I just always go back for many, many years. I just go back there. I a few times a year fly to LA and like go take a lesson. And these lessons take days. They literally take days to do. Like I stay at his house and they go on and on throughout the day. Like he'll listen to what I'm doing. I'll play the piano or something and go, oh yeah, well change this, take that. That whole middle section's wrong. Think this way or make it singable. Can you sing it? I can't sing it. Then it's wrong. Throw it away, you know? And he'll like, he's like a coach. He's like an athletic coach. He looks at your form and then tells you like where to move your arm or like make that step a little different. You know, he's there. He listens, you know, and he knows me. So I go through these lessons that take days and then I'll rewrite the thing and I'll play it for him. And then if he sees that I'm mastering what he's trying to get me to do, like I'm getting good at it, then he'll be like, okay, forget that. And I'll throw it away and then give me something I'm bad at, you know, and like he'll keep doing that and that'll go on. And it's funny. Sometimes he'll be in the next room, like on his little treadmill working out. He's even older than me. So he's got to really, you know, he's got to do his thing every day on his treadmill. That's where his like his brain is at. And, you know, and I'm in the next room at the piano doing what he told me to do, like rewriting a song. And I can, he's getting itchy in there. Sometimes he's like, no, not a B flat. Like he's yelling from the other room, you know?
I love a B flat. Exactly. It's like my perfect note to sing.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I'm going to write a whole song of B flats for you. Yeah.
Just the whole thing is E flat, A flat, B flat is like my favorite.
E flat, A flat, B flat.
That's like whenever
just right under the hand. I can like feel it right now on a piano. I could write a song with that.
I'm gonna make you write a song for me that's called
I could do it.
Three flats.
I'll do it in this podcast. I'll write a song.
At one point I'll get the piano open and you write your three flat song.
I'll do it on the spot. So anyways, I really want to answer this question. I feel compelled to like somehow sum it up, but Lawrence has taught me a lot about myself. So studying what I do from him definitely shaped that. And you pointed out things like what instruments I choose as a part of my sound. Just because I like certain instruments and they're useful, you know, but and they're available. But I could write for anything. I honestly write for all kinds of instruments. If you really look into stuff I've done for films or like dig around on the albums into the deepest corners of the albums, you hear everything. Orchestral instruments, world instruments, jazz instruments, folk instruments. I do use everything. And, you know, if you check out like the stuff I did for Big Apple on the Grand Tour, it's very diverse. One of the problems, I mean, everyone complains about this. I never thought I would complain about it. And it's not really a problem, really, but it's a surprise to me. And it's something that like, it isn't true and I have to deal with it. But people do think I only do one thing. Like I have a sound. Mm-hmm. Not everyone agrees on what that is. But some people say like, oh, it's kind of klezmer. Like, don't you do, you know? And I've had people like circus artists say, I want you to write some music for my act, but do you do anything other than klezmer? Like I've had people say that. And it's like, well, I'm proud that anything I've done that sounds like klezmer is so convincing that that's what they think I do only, you know? And then other people say, oh, don't you only do that old time vintage American jazz sound like from turn of the century? Isn't that, have you ever done anything else? And it's like, I'm always surprised at what thing it is that they think that I do, but it's actually quite diverse what I've done. And I don't know, I guess it's just something you have to live with because people are comfortable with that. Like people may look at you guys one day and say like, oh, they do that virtual reality circus thing. Mm-hmm. And isn't that all? You could produce probably 100 shows that have no virtual reality. And like, since it's like the first thing that puts you on the map, maybe that's all anyone would ever say for a long time. You might have to deal with that. You know? Maybe just because they like it.
Or it's like the stuff that they've actually seen, you know?
Yeah. And there's stuff they haven't seen.
Well, you know, we're going to give everybody who's listening sort of an intro class to the mind of Peter Orfano. When we're talking about doing this together, I suggested that we do some kind of song exploder version of one of your songs. For those who don't listen to the podcast, Song Exploder, this guy he has his guests take apart different tracks and talk about why he wrote them and the references for them and sort of give an insider view into the song. And I love podcasts so much, I asked Peter to do that for us. So we're going to listen to Peter's song, The Romantic, and talk about it afterwards.
The Romantic is a song that's about a character who's busy preparing this romantic candlelight dinner, the cooking and the setting of the table and making everything just so, and the preparation of the flowers, etc. And I think at its inception, the concept came to me because I had seen Jenny Vidbell on the Big Apple Circus Grand Tour doing an act where she had a romantic dinner with a dog. And my twist on it would be that, oh, wouldn't this be interesting if it were an eccentric or a comedic character who's clumsy, not so smart, not so lucky? That's what we see. But that internally, this person's inner dialogue is that they're quite suave and debonair and skillful in the kitchen and quite romantic, and that they consider themselves a romantic. And so the music, before I'd even written a note of it, I had the idea that this would be the music of this eccentric character's inner thoughts or inner feelings, not what we're seeing, which is totally the opposite. The way I compose music generally is melody first, pencil to paper. I sit at the piano or I sing, and I come up with a tune. And if you really want to understand where the melody of the romantic comes from, you have to look at another song from the album, which is called The Last Long Mount. The Last Long Mount is a song I wrote about a year ago when Ringling Brothers was staging the final performance with Elephants in Providence, Rhode Island. And the long mount is this thing that I remember seeing it as a kid, where they'd have 20 elephants spread out across the entire length of an arena, and they would stand up on their hind legs and put their forelegs on the back of the elephant in front of them, and they'd make this sort of big, kind of like mambo kick line of elephants. It's huge. They're standing up vertically, so they're towering above you, and it's the entire length of it's an arena full of exotic animal moving together in a dance-like spectacle. It is something that is almost undescribable, really, and if you've never experienced it, you may never know what it was, but it left a big impression on me as a kid. The long mounts over the years got shorter and shorter. And probably the last long mount had at most a half a dozen elephants in it. It's kind of a sad event from my perspective, so I wrote this little waltz, which turned out to be rather funereal, rather sad and simple. Makes a good last track for an album. But I also felt like, gosh, that is very dark. And maybe there's a possibility with this melody, which is lighter. And so I did attempt to do this. I moved along quick, like a halftime kind of swing, and had a bounce to it, reharmonized it a little bit, made this light swing thing, and it went totally the opposite direction. It wasn't in the middle ground as I had hoped. It's this bright, happy kind of a treatment of the same melody. And I thought, oh, this works for the concept I have of the romantic, and started to complete it with that in mind. And to get into the specifics of how I actually assemble a melody, like what methods I use, I like it to be singable first and foremost, and catchy and hooky, something that people hear once or twice and then they are singing it. So I'm always checking that. I write down a little motif, I string together a few notes, and I sing them back. Or I don't even use a piano at all. I just sing it so that I know it's singable because I'm actually singing it when I write it, and I commit it to pencil and paper with little revisions. Oh, maybe if I lower this note or I raise that note, it'll be catchier, you know? And then I don't want it to be too catchy and too boring and too easy to sing and sound like a child's playground song. I don't want that. I want it to have something interesting. And in this case, the first interval I pick is this augmented fourth interval. It's a very dissonant interval. It contains a note that's not in the key of the song, and it's, you know, harder to sing the interval, and it's weird. It's weird sounding to start right out of the gate with this level of dissonance. But I like creating a little bit of a problem because then the melody becomes about solving that problem, and it becomes memorable and interesting in that way too. So that's something that I did as I started to come up with the basic motif of this. And then you have this simple little motif, this fragment of a melody. Da, na, 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 na. And one of the first things I tried to do is just repeat it, but with omitting the final note. So you put those two things together, and now you're like on to having a melody. And I do this. I go back to my original motif and flip it upside down or truncate it or elongate it. I manipulate it in some way to build other sections of the melody that I need so that it's all cohesive and it's all sourcing the same basic elemental materials and comes from the same place. Nothing's ever wasted. And I continue this way until I have a whole song, you know, which is, I don't know, like a 24-bar song or a 64-bar song, something like that. And the next step is to create a MIDI demo or, you know, a demo of me playing it on keyboards in the computer, not real instruments. And this serves a purpose of like kind of hearing it come together as an arrangement with a little more an orchestrated feel. And it gives me the ability to play it for other people and get feedback on it. The final step is me getting into the recording studio with real musicians to get a real performance out of the thing. And in this case, we recorded about a year ago in May in Camden, Maine, at her studio. We recorded this, I think, about 4 or 5 times, just to have like a few different performances to pick from. And we stopped once we had one that everybody felt good about, and that's the one that we kept. I don't think we even listened to the first few takes of it very much. One, two, three. The basic rhythm section was playing on that. I had Claudio Ragazzi playing guitar, Dave Harris playing the tuba, Grantley Smith is playing the drums in that recording. I'm playing the piano there. Keita Hostetter is playing the violin, Sam Dasheen is playing the trumpet, and Sammy Lett is playing the saxophone. The accordion part I recorded later because I can't play the accordion and the piano at the same time, and the same is true for the trombone. That's Dave Harris, the tuba player, who plays the trombone in the song. Those were overdubs. Also, the solos that you hear in the middle of the song. There's a short guitar solo and a short trumpet solo. We didn't record those originally in the take because we weren't sure who should play a solo. No one felt that strongly about it. So we just left it open. We left the space there for a solo. And when we came back to the thing, the first thing we tried was recording Claudio Ragazzi, the guitarist, playing a guitar solo in that space. And it's amazing. That's the first thing you hear in the solo section. And we also just tried, just to have an option, we recorded Sam Dasheen, the trumpet player, playing a solo in the song. And he also recorded an amazing solo. And I was left with the dilemma of picking one. This was really difficult. They're both amazing solos to hear them in their entirety. And I, as a compromise, what I decided to do was the first half of the solo, you hear Claudio Ragazzi's first half of his solo.
And then it transitions to the second half of Sam Dashin's solo for the second half of that solo section. So you never actually get to hear the entirety of what each of them played, but I assure you, it is amazing. And it was hard to make a choice to split them in half. When we started to record the song, the guys were playing it like kind of a little too modern and slick in a way. I felt like in trying to keep with the inner personality of this character, the romantic, I thought, well, you know, maybe it's kind of a little bit vintage sounding. You know, maybe the tuxedo's got a couple holes in the wool, you know, and he's not that hip. He might think he's kind of hip, but he's not that hip. And it really helped the guys get some character in the kind of old-timiness of the flavor. I didn't want to overplay it because I don't think clown music should be funny necessarily. Sometimes I think clown music should be dead serious because the clown himself or herself, they are dead serious in their psychology. And I like playing to that rather than what we see, which is that they're ridiculous. So, you know, I wanted to find a balance somewhere, and I think that the guys did a good job of doing that. The entire song was recorded by John Escobar, who also mixed and mastered the album. And John set up everything more or less using one big room. The drums and the tuba are isolated into a smaller part of that room, and so is the guitar. 1, 2, 3. Everything else is in this nice big wooden space, which is something you can kind of hear. It's a very natural way to record things, and it has a lot of depth to it. And it's a characteristic of the entire album that I like a lot. I feel like the space itself that you record in is in some way like one of the musicians. It is a character, a contribution. It's a factor in the end result. And I like what we get from that room up there at her studio, which is very live and real. You can kind of hear the sound bounce around off the wooden ceilings and stuff because the space used to be a barn. The last chord of the whole song winds down in this kind of a wah wah. There's a sort of a, you know, I don't know how you describe it, but it's supposed to align like the it's the blow off or the punchline of the joke where, you know, the date shows up finally for this romantic dinner and it's not a girl. It's a dog, and the dog shows up, and he gives the dog the flowers that he had prepared, and the dog eats the flowers and runs off, you know? So you get this kind of a, I guess the hope with a clown gag is that you build up a certain expectation, and at the end, there's a switch, and you get a little bit of a laugh, or we all get to laugh at ourselves, maybe.
Something I want to talk about, a Facebook post that I saw you post about not wanting to see the last Ringling show, because we are going on Sunday, but I want to know why you don't want to go.
I have a whole lifetime of memories of that show. I just remember it from when I'm 5, maybe younger, and they're good memories. And they're vivid to me, and I'm so happy with the connection I've had to that show. Like, I can think of all these cities. I can think of looking at so many cities in the United States out the window of a train. I can think of the songs I was listening to in the train. I can think of the people I knew backstage. I loved the show so much. When I was 17, 18 years old when I first joined Ringling and went out to work for them. So, like, on tour, you know, we were doing 12 shows a week, sometimes more, like 13. Like, it was a very busy schedule. And I did, I guess, 1,000 shows as a clown with Ringling, 1,000 performances, probably something like that. And most of them, I spent the show not like back in the dressing room, talking to the guys, watching a TV, not reading a book. Like I stood at the door and watched people's acts for 1,000 shows. It didn't get old to me. I liked watching it. I remember their acts. I remember their faces. And the buildings, all the arenas, I remember.
So it's to make you want to see the last show, though.
No, because here's the difference of this is that, like, I think it would overwhelm those memories. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, I have seen the show. And I've seen this production. I've seen it even just a few weeks ago. Like, yeah. It's so monumental, the last day. Mm-hmm. It is such a big deal to me that I don't want it to erase the bigger deal, which is my whole life.
Sort of like seeing a sick family member... don't talk about it. This is dark. But sort of like seeing a sick family member at the end of their life and you want to remember them as the person you knew them for. Totally.
I didn't even make this connection, but you're informing me of who I am. You're teaching me who I am. It's so true. Because when my sister died a couple years ago and she was the youngest sibling. So it's like really unexpected. Yeah. Thank you. It was unexpected circumstance. She took her own life. And she was 40, so she's like really young. And people didn't, you know, for the people knew that like she was unhappy. She had a rough year. But I still think, of course, everybody was shocked and devastated to a point where like, you know, aside from all the like the normal grief and the horribleness of that, like I was noticing like people are forgetting this amazing 40 years that she had. It was an amazing, she had a great life, like an amazing life. She created so many, she was a performance artist, a dancer. She created all these beautiful things. She met a lot of people all over the world and touched them deeply. She really had an amazing life. But there was a point, because her death was so abrupt and shocking and jarring to people, that like they could only remember like the last few minutes of her life.
Oh my gosh, this is a therapy session.
Yeah, totally.
I've
processed this like whole thing and I've talked to like people close to me and my family and said, like, you have to remember, like, she did have an amazing life. Her life wasn't the last few minutes of her life. That's really nothing, really. And not even symbolic of anything of her life. It's unfortunate, you know. She had a great life. And so in some way, I think I'm connecting the Ringling thing. I wasn't making the connection until you just made that analogy. But that, like, I just want to remember everything that was cool in my life about Ringling. I don't want to remember... You know,
the tainted last thing.
And you know, I'll say this, I think it's great that people are going. I love hearing like people went to the last Red show and I'm like, so tell me, you know, like, I wanted to hear about it. I did want to participate and I did feel left out, but at the same time, I don't think I can handle, I don't want to be remembering that day.
Yeah.
I want to remember a million other days.
So I get that.
You guys will give me the report.
I will.
Exactly.
You make me feel like I was there. And I have friends on the Blue show now. You know, I talk to them all the time. Some of them are coming to work on Smirkus this year.
Oh, wait, we'll be at Smirkus too.
Yeah.
I'll give you my report on that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Last year at Smirkus, I was like, that was amazing. It was better than a lot of shows I've seen.
Oh, that's good to hear. Because you know, I was playing the keyboard in it, so I don't always have a perspective on it.
Oh, you were playing the keyboard?
I played a keyboard on Smirkus last year, the flight year. So I can't even tell you, like, I don't have an opinion about it. I never really got out front and saw it. I didn't write the music. I was just playing on it. I just, you know, they pieced together a music team kind of at the last minute. Some things fell through and they pieced together a composer and myself at the last minute. We all just like showed up and I had no perspective on what that show looked like or sounded like.
So my parents saw it. I mean, because I saw Smirkus when I was maybe like 12, 13 with my parents. Mm-hmm. Totally forgot about it. And then he was like, I was in Circus Smirkus. I think I've seen that show. And so my parents haven't seen it since, you know, they took us when we were little. And so we brought them last summer. And my mom was like, they're so professional. They look like real people. And I was like, they are real people. They train harder than most people in New York, I think. Mm-hmm. And
they do train harder.
I mean, we go to the circus rehearsal spaces and you see people in there training and they're fine. And then you go see Smirkus and they're just like another level.
Yeah. It's a challenge for the creative team to deal with such a high level of talent.
So high.
In a way, I can see it. It's a struggle.
Window too.
Yeah, and I think there's a struggle of like, how do you make it exist? I don't even understand the problems, to be honest with you. And I try to just focus on what I can do to make it a better show. But like, how do you say like...
It's the Patriots mentality. Do your job.
Yeah, totally.
Massachusetts reference.
Yeah.
I want to ask... is there a show that you would really love to compose for that you haven't done yet?
Oh, man. Anything that I can make a difference, make a contribution, anything, like any...
But it's got to be like Ringling's one you saw as a kid where you were like, that show, I love being part of that would be something special. Is there another show that you sort of feel that way about that you haven't had the chance to do yet?
I mean, I'm an artist.
I see shows... I want to work with a dancer now. Like, I want to get away from circus for a second and, like, clear my head. I'm obsessed with dancing now. I'm kind of thinking, like, I've never worked with dancers outside of a circus context.
Well, we know a lot of dancers.
Yeah, you guys know the dancers. I don't know. I haven't touched it. I haven't gotten into it. I feel like I maybe have something to say there in that world with dancers. And I'm starting from the point, I've been asking the dancers I know. I've been saying, like, what kind of dance has no music? What kind of dance is not dependent on this? Because it seems like the vast majority of dance doesn't even exist without music. It wouldn't start. It wouldn't happen. People wouldn't feel compelled to move, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, like, I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been really thinking about dance as the
thing.
It's
funny you ask that question because Keone, who choreographed Samba with his wife, Mari, who's also a previous guest on the podcast, is asking himself similar questions when he was over. And one of the exercises he did with a group of students to just explore what he was musing personally was he was like, let's do a dance where we use no music, but you guys have to breathe and shuffle your feet on the ground and let the dance make the noises music. And then almost work backwards from that
moment. Yeah, because so much is about the music. It's like this little like hit. You know, and that's like the beat that you accentuate. Mm-hmm. And then when you see someone dance without the music, you're like, that looks weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've been thinking about this. And I just did the Bindlestiff Cardboard and Duct Tape Spectacular. Part of my job on that is to conduct the band, you know. And so I've been thinking about this thing of like, where is there dance with no music? I need to start there so that I can make music for dance. So that I can't start from already music there. You wouldn't like... go to a great painter like Renoir or something and say like, okay, so here's a Picasso. Yeah. Can you just do a painting over this?
Yeah, I need the background.
Yeah. Like I need to start from nothing, you know? And so like, where is dance with nothing?
Or maybe you start, you don't start necessarily from nothing, but you start from whatever the same thing the dancer wants to explore.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But I've been, that's the question I started with, is where's the dance with nothing? And I've been asking dancers. And then I was on stage the other night with the Bindlestiffs doing this thing. And I was like, I conducted the band and I went, you can't see, I'll describe that. I just lifted my arm and dropped it, you know, but there is a dance to this. There is a movement to this that like, it is dance inspiring music. Like I'm moving to get people to play music when I do that. So it's like, that's the other thing of then that was like a switch flipped. I was like, oh, because usually we think of music as being the catalyst
ballet,
of dance.
Right? When
you know?
When they go like, they like in Lindsay's my ballet
also
classes.
Raising her arms.
Oh yeah, I'm doing a first position ballet pose. But I mean, you know, in ballet with when you would be lucky enough to have a live pianist and not just a recording, you know, you go like you'd set. And then they'd go, right?
And they go because they see that you've initiated this breath, this thing, you know. That's what conducting was for me. And it did flip a switch and it did make me think like, oh, I want to start to think about this thing about dance now. I want to work with dance. I'm going to see some dance tonight. Kara Seymour from Nocturne, she was one of the dancers in Nocturne, is dancing at La Mama tonight.
Oh,
I'm going.
Fun.
You guys should come.
What's tonight? What's today? What is today?
Thursday. Connecticut tonight.
Oh, yeah. Connecticut.
Got some location scouting.
Nice. Oh, I watched, I saw on your Insta feed a little teaser of the archery in the Nevada Canyon. That looked beautiful. That's the main kind of concept of your VR thing, right? Is that it's it's acts, but set in...
that's exactly
different
it.
Places.
Yeah.
Different. It's sort of pulling... The basic concept is just that it's like a circus show, a variety show with really amazing circus acts, all in beautiful locations, all with really good music.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily anything more than that as what's tying together. We'll put you in it before you leave. Make our pod... You can get a little bit of a sneak peek. So we usually wrap the podcast with the same three classical questions. The first being...
Classical questions.
Classical.
They're now classical. 41.
Do I want to look at this, or this is something else?
No, that's
right?
That's
for
post podcast.
It's a secret.
Yeah,
okay.
People can't know the note I wrote to you. So the first question is: has there been a piece of advice, good or bad, that you've gotten from somebody that's really stuck with you?
Jeez. I get lots of advice from people for some reason. I mean, people give me advice about like how to write music and how to do business and stuff, but or how to take a stage, you know, like how to be on stage. But I think actually the thing that I probably use every single day, and especially when I'm having like problems about like collaboration or problems about like working through issues with directors and stuff, I think the thing is listening. I think that is the best advice I've received, is to like stop and listen in depth to people, especially people who I disagree with, especially people who are very different than me, who have very different opinions, especially people who may even be a threat. Like, stop and listen. I'll tell you where I got this advice. I was having like a big legal problem with a music agent, like a television placement agent, a contractual issue, and like a royalties issue. And I was losing sleep over it. I felt really stuck in a bad contract, in a bad business relationship. It would cost a lot to get out of it, maybe lose more getting out of it than I was losing being in it. You know, it was very difficult. It was long distance. And I asked Derek Sivers, who's the guy who started CD Baby, like, what would you do with this? Like, and I was looking for legal advice or something. I was looking for like a technical thing. Like, what's the move to force their hand to get out of this? And he said, just get them on the phone as long as you can. Get them on the phone for like an hour, 2 hours. Get them talking. Don't say anything. Get a list of questions. Ask them questions. Don't respond to any of the questions. Don't get sucked in any arguments. Don't point out what they're wrong about. Like, just sit there and listen to them. They'll explain the whole thing to you. Like, they'll get you out of it, you know, through their own words. That was really good advice. I do now. I have to use that every day to get through creative problems with people. I have to just like sit there and listen.
It's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yep.
The second question that we ask is there a book or a movie or a show or maybe a song that is a reference that you think is wonderful that you want to share with people?
Oh, man. Songs are hard because I mean, I just listen to so many different things all the time. I could never pick a song.
Maybe it's an album, or maybe it's maybe it's an act with a song.
I'll tell you what's a good movie to watch. I think this is a good movie. It does have good music in it, but that's not even why. I think the good movie to watch is Amelie.
Great movie.
You like that too?
Oh, yeah.
Why do you like it?
Now.
I think that movie is great because it's a amazing example of the use of a visual palette in a movie. Like the use of color, the use of cinematography. The music is beautiful, but so much of it is told by showing it to you as opposed to saying it that... it's just awesome. Which is also why when it was going to be a Broadway musical.
It is a Broadway musical. It's going to close
in about 2 weeks.
Oh, I'm never
making
to go
it a Broadway
see it.
Musical. I was like, what? Why?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me. But because, not because the story is not good enough, but because what made that movie special to me was its unique use of cinematic traits that inherently don't work in any other
medium.
It's not
going to make it. Like, what are they going to put in the musical that they can put in a musical?
I read the script. I mean, it's been in development forever. I've read it maybe like 4 years ago when I was working at this producing office, and part of my job was basically read scripts and then say if we should invest or not. And I read it and I was like, pass, you should pass. This should not be a musical.
But it's probably been rewritten 1,000 times since.
So why do you say it as a movie to watch though?
Well, it's funny. Mine is like, that's all. I'm in 100% agreement with you on all those points. Which is how I came to know it, is that like, it's a great telling of a story. Like, the telling of the story is even better than the story itself. Hardly anything happens. Like, so in a way, it's like the telling is so beautiful to look at. But apart from all that, the thing that why I said, oh, it's a good movie to watch, is because it's a movie that just reminds you to be alive every minute. It's like, to pick up a rock is like, you're totally alive, you know, to look out the window, you're totally alive. You know, like everything, every moment she has is like, she is so alive.
That scene where she's sitting on the roof and she's unplugging her dad's television has just like stuck with me my entire life since I very first saw that.
Yep. And then there's a scene where two people are like, I think two people are making love in like the bathroom of the cafe, and she can kind of hear it going on. And like, she's even like, she's egged this whole thing. She thinks in her world, she's created this romance. You know, and she hears it kind of going on in the other room, and she's making noises to cover up the sounds that they're making and stuff. And she's like, but there's a lot of shots of her face, and it's pure delight for her. Like, it's just pure delight. And then there's like, well, the whole, every moment is her face and like what, and how alive she is, you know, it's like, it's to be alive and simple things, simple little things like food, you know? And so that's a good movie to always, it reminds me of like, you don't have to be doing anything important. You don't have to be making a lot of money. You don't have to be really doing anything at all. You'd be sitting here at this table right now and be totally alive. You don't need any excuse to be alive. Mm. You just do it, you know? So that's a good, that's
great reference. Late.
Yeah.
I double down on that one.
Yeah. Has anyone ever suggested that one before?
No.
Nope. No. That's original.
I would suggest, if someone asked me that question, I'd be like, The Goonies.
Yeah.
Teaches you about friendship.
And Massachusetts. And then, what's his name?
It's like, I don't know.
That's good.
I should look. Anyway, last question.
All right.
Who do you think we should have on the podcast that we have not yet had on?
Well, you've definitely already had all of my friends on the podcast.
Except about Jeff and Julie.
That's true. They would be great. Jeff and Julie would be great. What about, have you guys ever had Frodo?
Want to get Frodo on there.
Yeah. And what about Casey Wilson?
Casey would be great as well.
Mm-hmm. She's great to talk. I love her so much. I love talking to her.
We should write that down.
Yeah.
Frodo, Brett Pfister also suggested.
Yeah.
Frodo.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so Frodo's been recording his own podcast, apparently.
Oh, really?
But has not yet released
oh.
it. But
is he keeping it on the top secret, or is he going to put his name on it?
I think because he and Joran Dawson, who was a cast member in Slumber, were working on it together.
Yeah.
And there was a theme to it or something. I don't know enough detail, but he would be great.
I've kept my podcast so top secret for so long that now it's like, I couldn't believe it, but I was talking to somebody in the podcast world recently, and they were like, how long have you had your podcast? And I had to like go look at files online. I was like, oh my God, it's been over a decade.
Wait, you have a podcast?
And no one knows because I don't tell anyone like what, it doesn't have my name on it and I don't tell anyone about it. And so, because it's always me having some big dilemma. It's always like some big crisis, you know? And so I've always thought like, I'm not going to be able to freely keep podcasting if everyone in my professional world knows that I'm doing it. So I have
that
really never like
podcast.
Spread it around, but people know, like if you ask around, people have found it and noticed that it's me. They hear my voice and they're like, you know, whatever, but it's been going a long time. So
what's it called?
Well, he just revealed that he wanted to keep it.
Maybe we should put a link in the thing. And then anyone who's like
who's
ambitious enough
hour,
to like go look.
Yeah. And look.
Put a link. There's a link in the thing.
Yeah.
There's a link in the
link in the description.
Click the I button.
Yeah.
Peter, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, man. Thank you for
us.
Having me.
I just would like you to score my life.
Okay.
Just while I walk.
That was our episode with Peter Bufano.
If you like that episode and our podcast, please make sure to follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, read us on iTunes, or you can email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Thanks for listening. And if you stay tuned after, you'll hear Peter's one-of-a-kind song for me.
Enjoy.
I want you to create a song right now.
With your three notes?
With my three notes.
Okay.
Are you going to play the piano?
Yeah, I can do it. I'll do it. Let's get this
thing. Piano is awesome. I know, sorry. It's like we have to reorganize the office a little bit, and I just keep putting stuff on the piano. And then I move it, and then I put it back.
Wow, and there's a whole whiteboard here that gives me.
Reschedule me.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're going to check. Wait.
Check. And we saw that. I was like, I can't believe they haven't had Julia.
Underline. They're awesome. They're the best. All right. I'm using what? E flat, B flat, and A flat. Can I use any other notes?
You can use that as like the
that's the main thing.
The core, and then you can do.
Tell me what the act is. Tell me.
So,
talk me through it.
Okay,
give me the lights. Give me everything.
Okay,
get me in there.
Should we move that microphone to the? Or will it pick you up?
It'll get. It's aimed here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the lights. It's just four overhead white lights. Creating like a spotlight on the stage in four places, all across the front. Oh, I love it already. And then it's like three girls. One's on like swinging trap in the back, so you can just like sort of see her. And then there's two girls in the front, and they're doing like an amazing hand-to-hand act.
So it's like a Ringling show. Two things going on at once.
Two things going on at once, but like the swinging trapeze is always just like ambiance. Like she's just like in a white flowy dress, just like in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Made it up on the song.
There's a good basic texture.
That sounds great.
Right? I'm just playing the notes on it. I don't know, and then if I'm really writing a song, I'd want a melody to come in somewhere.
Well,
yeah,
then it's like the main girl.
Who's the main girl? What's she talking about?
Because,
okay.
But so like,
in the background. Tell us about her.
Okay, so she, well, no, she's just the background, like, but then she gets revealed, and you're like, oh, it's actually about her. She's like this girl who's like, okay, like, I just went through a massive heartbreak, and I'm going to find me before I try to look for anyone to fulfill my life.
Okay. All right. I like her. I like her so much.
And her name is, like, Marnie.
Marnie. It sounds like a musical. I'm in a bad direction. Let me try something. What's we need something about Marnie. What's her, like, okay, we need some of her damage. Like,
okay,
maybe,
her
like,
damage.
What's complicated about her?
Okay, so she was prepared to move.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
The person who taught her trapeze is her ex.
Oh, so it's hot. So it's like painful for her to do trapeze because everything
it's her
she learned
skill, but
is
wow.
From the man
so
that she loved and broke her heart.
Exactly.
And he left her for one of the hand-to-hand girls.
Let me work something out here. It does need something heavy about it, you know? It's like, it needs problems.
It needs problems. These are our problems.
It needs some pain, some dissonance. I'm looking for it. Like this. Yeah.
Sus chord.
Yeah. It's like it's a sus chord mixed with a chord that's not related. I need another one. Kind of oscillating away from that's different. Yeah. You do this long enough, it doesn't sound horrible.
I love it. No, I like it. It's like Stephen Sondheiming.
Yeah, I wanted to go to a crunchier place.
Yeah.
Piano gets you into like sounding like you're writing on the piano, and it's good to get away from a piano
right.
too, like, and think of a lot of other instruments, and all those same notes on a different instrumentation or something could be a different world, you know, or a
right.
different tempo, or, you know, a different range. I think about these things all the time. I'm always trying to just come up with an idea, you know.